You're listening to the most captivating podcast in iTunes. That's right, the Elite Man Podcast, where we turn average men into elite men every day. We interview the very best experts from the lifestyle, health, fitness, social, and even entrepreneurial worlds. And with their help, we give you some of the best advice on the planet. Subscribe now if you haven't already and enjoy the show. And oh yeah, if you really enjoy it, leave us a review. On today's episode, episode number 240, entitled, How to Liberate Your Mind and Take Control of Your Health, Relationships, Success, and Happiness, I chat with Dr. Stephen C. Hayes. Dr. Stephen C. Hayes is a clinical psychologist, author of 46 books and over 600 scientific articles, and the developer of relational frame theory and acceptance and commitment therapy. In today's episode, Dr. Hayes talks about how to liberate your mind from all the clutter and noise of today's chaotic world. He shares decades of research and empirical wisdom from being a true pioneer in the psychology world and what he's learned about optimizing your mind. If you're wondering how to free your mind from stress, anxiety, worry, and depression, and tap into thinking and experiencing life in an optimal state, check this episode out now. You are going to love it. If you haven't checked out our YouTube channel yet, there's two reasons why. A, you're probably living under a rock and you haven't listened to any other Elite Man podcasts in the past. Or B, you're completely insane and you've just ignored all the messages that I've told you to check them out in the past. Either way, make sure you check it out right now. This is your last chance if you have not checked it out yet. And if it's been a while since you've checked some of our videos out, make sure you go back on and check them out today. I'm telling you, you are going to love some of our new videos. Go to elitemanmagazine.com/YouTube. And check them out today. Make sure you like some of the videos if you like them, comment on some of the videos to leave your feedback, and subscribe to our channel if you have not subscribed yet. And also, if you want to be super helpful and go one step further as an elite man, share some of our videos on your social media with some of your friends. I really do appreciate it personally, and I know my team does as well. We're trying to grow this as much as possible, so spreading that message with some of your friends who can benefit from watching these videos is one of the best things you can do for them and also for us. Again, go to elitemanmagazine.com/YouTube and check our channel out. You are going to love it. All right, guys, we're live. It's Justin Stenstrom from elitemanmagazine.com. And my guest today is Dr. Stephen Hayes from the University of Nevada. Dr. Hayes, thanks so much for coming on the show today.
It's great to be with you here, Justin.
And I think I already messed up the Nevada.
You did. It's Nevada.
That's 28 years of just ingrained the wrong pronunciation in me, so apologize for that. How do you say it's it? Hard.
If you come as a referee on our football games or something, the entire stadium screams.
Yeah, he just warned me of messing that up too before we jumped on officially, but I still did it anyways. But Steve, it's great to have you on, man. Really appreciate your time. And you just came out with a recent book, A Liberated Mind. What is the book about exactly? And I know you got some references from guys like Mark Manson, who's been on the show as well, has a fantastic book. And how'd you get in contact with Mark, actually?
Well, you know, he's been a bit of an ACT fan, acceptance and commitment therapy, or acceptance and commitment training, depending on when they use it in therapy or not. And has, you know, he's actually put things out on books. Unfortunately, not usually mine, even though I kind of started this whole thing, but still. And he gave me a really nice blurb just saying it's one of the most useful things he's come across. And if you get what he's up to, there's a resonance here. But we're on the science side. We're the kind of geeky Western science, pull it apart at its joints side of it. And it's cool when you find things that resonate like that. So yeah, I think that's why he likes it.
So how many years have you been doing this work?
40 years.
40 years. And what exactly, for the listeners who haven't maybe heard your name, what exactly are you a professor of?
Of psychology. I'm in the behavior analysis program. But, you know, what I do is I've been trying to chase the cognitive processes that underline success or failure, that sort of underlie it. And, you know, to get this thing distilled down to the 20% that does the 80%. And Early on, I developed panic disorder, and walking out of it, I discovered some things that you could do that were powerful, but I didn't put it out into the normal kind of book level things. I was doing geeky science until I knew what the processes were. And what's in the Liberated Mind is finding out about 20 years after I put the technology out, what are the underlying processes and how can you use them? And so it's kind of cool because it turns out these processes go everywhere that a human mind goes. So you could sort of say I'm a kind of a explorer of the mind, and I'm trying to figure out, you know, what the heck, why are we like how we are? And like, what are we doing right now? You and I right now, what is this thing called symbolic thinking. So, how does it work?
Yeah. So the foundation of what you teach, though, is acceptance and commitment therapy, ACT is the acronym. What is, does that apply just to mental health or just to things like panic attacks, anxiety, depression, or does it apply to, like you said before, like finding the keys to success in all different aspects of life?
It's the latter, and that's what's cool about it, because when you dig down and you really get the processes about how does the mind work and how does it lead us astray and how can it help us, you know, well, then you kind of get the keys to the kingdom. And so, yeah, it's there's about, if you know the world of randomized trials, there's about 310 of these things, and about 40% of them are in mental health, anxiety, depression, substance use, you name it. But then about 40% of them are in physical health or stepping up to the challenge of physical disease, things like that. And then about 20% of them are really cool. They're parts I, in ways, some ways I love the most because they're about things like relationships or high performance or what do you do about stigma and prejudice. And, you know, we've been able to put it into sport and business and all those kinds of things and just watch how it works. And it turns out it kind of works the same in all these areas because it's not a technology for the mentally ill, whatever the heck that means. You know, this little shoving people into cubbyholes is a really weird thing that, you know, the academic psychiatry and Western medicine has been doing. But instead, it's like, what are the processes that lead your life downward or upward? And when you get that, well, that applies to everywhere a human mind goes.
Yeah. So can you walk me through the foundations of how you came across this? Like what type of research, what type of books, what type of information did you stumble across to actually help you out when you were starting to go through panic attacks and anxiety and like sort of come up with this whole idea on your own?
Well, really not on my own. You know, you bring things that you learned earlier together and you move them forward. And in the book, I tell a lot of my personal story and even some things that are there in my childhood that I think were helpful. But you're talking to an old hippie and, you know, I was a cognitive behavioral guy and I still am to some ways, been president of those societies, all that kind of stuff. And that's cool. But when I really had that gut check of panic disorder spinning me down to the point where I couldn't freaking give a lecture to five undergraduates, it was only when I turned in the direction of acceptance, mindfulness, the kind of stuff that hippies are into, and found traction, things that are in the human potential movement or in Esalen or in Gestalt therapy or all this fruit nut seed mix of kind of stranger things, if you really have a heavy science spin on it. Now it seems normal. I mean, I know you have interest in mindfulness and stuff, but you back up to the 70s and 80s when I'm in, you know, walking into this and nobody, I mean, there's no Jon Kabat-Zinn, there's no, you know, nobody is talking mindfulness in the evidence-based wing. But when I turned in that direction, I got traction on my own problems in a very, very rapid way. And I said, wow, something's in here. And I literally created a new theory of cognition, which now has several hundred studies to try to understand how the mind works that could do that. And then digging down to these change processes, we call them, the things that you do that lead your life into the dumpsters or, you know, up a hill of prosperity. And we got it down to six. I mean, there's more, of course. I'm not saying it's the only, you know, set, but it's the smallest set that does the most. And it'll sound like just bravado, but if you read the book, I think you'll come away with it. It's the smallest set that does the most with the most evidence than any other similar set in all of behavioral science and psychology. And it's not that well known in the popular culture other than the self-help books and the, you know, the kind of things that Mark Manson's applauding us for. He's reading some of our self-help books. But this book really walks through the history of it and then puts self-help in there and sort of says, we need to get this into our culture, in our homes, our churches, our businesses, because it's important. And the modern world is challenging us. And if we don't, we're going to have further problems where on almost every measure behaviorally, things are getting worse. And on almost every measure of physical success, you know, food, you name it, even things are getting better. Well, that's kind of a paradox. And let's see if we can make more progress on the psychological side, too.
Yeah. So when you say When you say you created a new theory of cognition, what does that actually mean? And what year, about what year was that done?
Well, the first article on it, the beginning article, that is 1984, the first really big presentation and study on it is in the late 80s, and then we nailed it by the early 90s. And now there's several hundred studies. I can sort of summarize it, in the book, I actually even walked through it. And frankly, when I pitched this book, there were a bunch of publishers who said, you cannot talk about this. This is too geeky. You can't do it. And I said, well, then I'm not doing the book with you. I'm just not doing it because this is too central. And bless them, you know, Penguin Avery said, okay, if you can do it. But if you can't do it, then we're taking it out. And I worked on it for like 3 years. The whole book took me 11 years to write. Wow. But here's the deal. Here's the deal. Most of the theories of cognition that are out there are built on association. If you want a metaphor for it, picture like Tinker Toys. If you still remember how Tinker Toys work, or Lego blocks or something, where you got little pieces and they connect to each other, and that's how the mind works. Yeah. It's not how the mind works. If you want to understand how it works, imagine you're at a big family gathering. Everybody's there, and you take a picture, and there's like 200 members of your family, okay? Every relationship between all those people could be worked out if you knew who they were. If a new person comes in, you say, hey, that's Sally's cousin. You now have like thousands of different arrangements. Plus, you can order them in terms of all the females, all the young ones, all the old ones, all the pretty ones. You got all these other things you can do. If you had to draw all the relationships that are possible in a big family picture, you couldn't see the picture. By the time you draw all the lines, okay, that's what the mind's like. Mm-hmm. And when you know that, you can take kids who can't think, can't reason, don't have a sense of self, kids on the autistic spectrum disorder who are more severe, for example, you can pull them into the human community. You can train language better. But for us, very likely, that's not our problem. If you're listening to this, that's not your problem. What your problem is the dictator within takes over. It starts telling you, it starts criticizing, it starts wagging a finger. And next thing you know, you're doing the wrong thing psychologically. And you're trying to go towards success, but you're playing a game where first you lose, then you play. You can't win that way. And when you know how the mind works, you can flip it. And first you win, then you play.
That's very interesting. So when you started doing this, the theory of cognition, are these like scientific academic papers found? Like if you go on PubMed, you can see different stuff of papers you've done? Oh, that's cool.
There's about, well, if you just look at mine, I've published 600 articles, 45 books. But if you go in and you just put into Google Scholar, which anybody can get to, and you put in things like psychological flexibility, put it in quotes, or experiential avoidance, something we'll probably talk about here, or even just acceptance and commitment therapy, put it in quotes. You know, you'll find around 3,500 studies, and that's a smaller set than is actually there because some of the things we work on are like values, mindfulness, things like that. And you put in those, you get tens of thousands. So, yeah, we're sitting on a mountain of evidence, and I'm not asking you to believe it. That's the last thing I'd ask you to do. I'm just asking you to consider it. And what the book does, hopefully in a non-geeky way, boy, did I work hard on that, and not just me, you know, people who know how to write, in a way that sort of says, here's a study, here's a study, here's a study, that opens up the door to things that we actually do. But the kind of the cool thing about it, the shocking thing about it, is we all know it. I can show it to people. In fact, if you let me play it a little game, I can prove it to you in a matter of like 30 seconds.
Yeah, let's do it.
You already know it. And the people listening already know it. Take something that's really hard psychologically. Get it clear in your mind. And now do this. Nobody's watching. You're by yourself. Put your body in a form that shows you at your worst with that psychological issue, such that if all you had to communicate with is your body and the shape it was in, I mean physically the shape, not how, you know, not your exercise shape, but I mean physically, like a sculptor would. And they walk by and they saw that, they might have a sense of what's going on inside you. Put your body in that form. Take a little mental snapshot. Now take the same exact issue, you at your best, because sometimes you handle it better. Put your body in a shape that shows you at your best with that issue. And take a little mental snapshot. We've done this around the world with several hundred people, and here's what it is, what happens. You at your worst, your head goes down, your eyes close, your arms come in, or your fists clench. You either flop into a heap or you curl over. You bring your arms and hands in. You begin to assume almost a semi-fetal position. You might even fall to the floor. You at your best, your head comes up, your eyes open, your arms and hands go out. You might stand up. You might stand in this way that's, you know, kind of like a, people call them power cues. How did you know to do that? Because you know that running and fighting and hiding from your own stuff is one of the worst things you can do. And you know the metaphor for your head up, your eyes open, being here as a whole person with your arms and hands free to do and your head free to move and your eyes open to see is a more powerful position. The only problem is your mind doesn't know it. Because when you start feeling something you don't like, it tells you, you got to run, you got to fight, you got to hide. And if you can't back up from that little dictator within, it'll drive you right off the edge of the cliff. And so there's other ones like this that, you know, I do with people to show that you already know it. And the cool thing about that is then when you read a book like this, you kind of go like, oh, yeah, there's like a Homer oh moment. Oh, yeah. Why am I doing that? And some of these things you write about, I looked at your website, you know, like where you kind of know not to take, for example, your values from mama just without thinking about it, or to not really do this kind of thing. My thinking is up to me. I'm not going to listen to my television program me or my iPhone. Well, how do you do that? And it turns out we can help guide people to how to do that. And that's what's in the book.
Yeah. So what do you think the reason why so many people forget this or they lose this type of information, this intuitive understanding of how to deal with different problems? What do you think it is about our culture and our society now that so many people have forgotten this?
Well, it's a combination of our culture and our society, and we're feeding the worst parts of us within for commercial purposes, not knowing what we're doing, and because science and technology has given us things that make it really hard for us, which I'll explain in a second, and because the tiger we're riding is only a few hundred thousand years old or maximum a couple million years. And, you know, the processes of learning that we're dealing with in a lot of our emotions, our thoughts, etc., are half a billion years old. How do you know that? Every organism since the Cambrian period, which is 540 million years ago, more than half a billion years ago, do learning by association, learning by operant conditioning, learning by reinforcement. Yeah, but what you and I are doing right now, Justin, only human beings do. Don't be telling me your dog does it in controlled studies. Your dog doesn't. A 12-month-old baby, if you give a name for an object and then say the name, they'll orient towards the object. The language-trained chimpanzees don't do it. You learn it in one direction, and you get a two-way street for free. That's cool. But then picture that family photo. It not only goes two ways, it goes in combination. So what I'm saying right now is changing your entire cognitive ecology. It's not like association. It's not like Tinker Toys. It's not like the chalk on one hand rubs on the other. It's this dynamic, gigantic network that is changing. And to master that, like the thing, just think of the things we normally would do. Oh, I don't like thinking about that. I'll think of something else. Dude, here's what you just did. It's a two-way street. It goes into networks. That thing you're now thinking of instead of thinking this is now related to this and will be an avenue to thinking about it even more readily. Mm. Like, I'm not a bad person. I'm a good person. And then the next time you have the thought, I'm a good person, there's a little whisper, you're a bad person. That's how the mind works. It's not logical. It's psychological. And so we do logical, reasonable, sensible, pathological things if you don't know how the mind works. And I think we've got kind of, we've unlocked the box. I think we've figured out, boy, it sounds so arrogant. I don't know about ACT, but I think our theory of cognition is the best thing out there. Bar none. We can do more with it, with more areas, implicit cognition, you set, et cetera. And once you unlock that puzzle, you go like, wow, a lot of the stuff we tell people to do with our thoughts, feelings, memories, bodily sensations are like really bad. Number one, they violate what you know because they're advice that tells you basically to run and fight and hide. or to deliberately change. But then that deliberate change is fine, but be careful, because you can open a back door to these paradoxical things of the more you try to think about it, the more you do. And you don't want to live inside a paradox. So we teach the skills as how to walk out of this sort of self-imposed box we get in with letting the mind dictate to us, instead of just using it when it's useful, like when you're doing your taxes or fixing your car, but not when you're trying to find peace of mind or purpose.
So if someone's getting anxiety, they're getting a panic attack, can you walk us through how you would use the theory of cognition or even ACT to get them out of that so their mind actually gets back on track?
Well, the first thing I would do is not try to get them out of it. I'd try to help them get into it.
Okay.
But get into it in a different way that transforms its function. Anxiety is not your enemy. There's no feeling you can name that isn't really useful for you in some circumstances, number one, and that you don't pay good money for under certain circumstances, number two. I mean, do you feel a bit of anxiety when you ride that roller coaster that is like the world's largest? You know, my son gets on these things that where the drops are like vertical and they're just ridiculously high. I just don't want to do it. I'm not doing it, but I'm watching him. And I do ride roller coasters, but a little tamer. And I always feel afraid. But I don't feel afraid like, oh, I'm not going to do that again. It's like, whoa, this is really scary. You know, it's like awesome. You know, and sometimes in ways that are shocking, like I did a big zip line for the very first time because I was always saying, oh, no, it's too afraid. And within about a second, when the zip line clicked and you started, I was literally shouting out loud, wee! So sometimes we don't even know. We live inside these little, oh, I can't do that. It's too hard, too emotional, too sad, too something. But so first thing, let's not get out of it. Let's get into it. Number two, could we take the time really to feel what you feel, notice what you think, notice what you remember in a way that's compassionate, kind, and mindful? Where in your body do you feel it? What does it remind you of? And then could you turn your attention towards what you want to bring into your next life moment in the world of behavior? So somebody, let's say, is at the mall. They've had panic attacks in the mall. They're avoiding the mall. This is an old home week for me. I mean, going in the mall was terror. You know, at that little moment, as you begin to drop the struggle, a metaphor we use, a client of mine came up with it years ago. It's like you're in the struggle with the anxiety monster, and you're pulling on a tug of war, and it's stronger than you. And no matter how hard you pull, it pulls you towards this deep pit. It's going to kill you. You're pulling even harder. And then it finally occurs to you, maybe I should just drop the rope.
Yeah.
We teach people how to drop the rope. And in, like in the mall, you can actually catch people's heads, just like I'm saying, literally comes up, their eyes open. And in that place, I might say something like, what would you buy that would be really cool to buy here? Or who has the most weird hairdo here? Or what does your mind tell you you can't do right now? And you get into this space, this kind of zone-crushing space, where with my clients, I've done things like go into the clothing store and order a hamburger, or fall to the floor and say out loud, help, help, we have panic, until people come over and look at us concerned. I mean, we just have a blast, you know, pushing the envelope out. Now, I don't want to trivialize that. I know from the inside out, dude, I know how hard it is to do some of these things when you're really visiting into this panic space where you feel you're completely out of control. But there's seeds in there that can lock you out of it. And most people who have anxiety have had that happen. Like in panic, they say, okay, kill me if you're gonna. And then the fog lifts. And next thing you know, they're saying, oh, I know a new way I can fight anxiety. Kill me if you're gonna. And it comes back. You can't trick yourself. And so if you're really ready to let go, show up, open your eyes, see what's possible, walk towards your values, ACT will show you how to do that. And it turns out you can do a hell of a lot of things with a hell of a lot of anxiety. You can probably even run a podcast really well.
Yeah, there's so many great points you make. And specifically with the roller coaster thing too, I've told this story in the past, so I don't want to get into too many details. But basically, many years ago, roller coasters were my number one fear out of everything in life. And I went to Six Flags one day with my buddy of mine who's a daredevil. And he ended up convincing me to go on the worst one there, like Bizarro, that one you're talking about with your son that just drops straight down and goes like, you know, 100 miles an hour or whatever, ridiculous. And I remember just being petrified, like walking up to, and the wait is always the worst too, like the building up of it.
Yeah, yeah.
The suspense. I remember just being terrified, like for half an hour waiting in the line because it was, you know, packed. We finally get in the thing and we're about to take off, and I'm just like ready to already die and like crawl over already and throw up because I always got sick when I went on the things. And I looked over at him and he's like putting his hands up. He's yelling. He's like swearing at the top. It's just being, and we're young and stupid, you know, being dumb. He's being super dumb and, you know, swearing at the top of his lungs, just like banging on stuff, like going crazy. And then I looked over at him and said something like, dude, we're about to die in a minute. Can you at least stop acting like an idiot or a jackass, you know, before we both at least die? At least do me that much. You convinced me on to get on this thing. Now you're acting like an idiot and you're making us both look stupid. And he said something. He didn't even mean it to be profound, but he looked over and said something like, Justin, like, this is what you have to do to ride these things. This is what you have to do to have fun. And I don't know what it was exactly at the time, but I decided, like, you know what? I'm going to try out what he's doing too and actually pretend like I'm enjoying it. And I started doing what he was doing, putting my hands up, yelling, screaming. We start to take off. After like the first big drop, I, against like all natural instinct, I put my hands up and started yelling at the top of my lungs. Next thing you know, for the next 2 minutes of riding through this thing, for the first time ever, I'm having fun on a roller coaster. And yeah. It was because I like stepped into the moment and actually didn't let the anxiety take over. I was just more of an observer of it and then actually welcomed it in. And it literally changed like my whole philosophy on anxiety and fears. And from that point forward, I loved roller coasters and other fears that I'd had in the past. Like I would do the same concept with the same strategy and I would get past them.
Yep. Well, you got past them because you got with them. I mean, what you did there is I'm going into it.
Yeah.
Right. I'm not trying to get out of it because you could have screamed, let me out of here. Let me out of here. You know, you could have fought your way out before the thing took away. But you know, or you could have just closed your eyes and pretend you weren't riding it. You would have had a miserable freaking ride. You know, so you did something incredibly wise. But how did you do that? I mean, I think it's, yeah, your friend kind of goaded you to it. Yeah. But part of it is you got to, we all have this. We have a wisdom within that we can rely on. There's a wiser part of us that knows that what we want to do, like in that case, is we want to feel. We came, you know, a baby doesn't have to be told, oh, you have to feel. Man, they'll reach out, they'll lick things, smell things, roll things around, you know, to the point that it's unsafe. You have to watch out for them, right? Because they haven't learned yet. But when you get that mind thing going, oh, I can't do that. Oh, I'm going to throw up. Oh, it's going to be awful. You know, that same voice will say, you can't leave the house. It'll tell you, you can't ask that person out for a date. It'll tell you, you can't have a promotion, that you can't, you know, ever be strong enough to be able to compete athletically. It'll walk you into a place where you're waiting for your freaking life to be over.
Yeah.
You know, and your mind doesn't know how to live. It's a tool for human beings who know how to live. But you need to learn how to live and use this tool instead of having this tool use you. And that's what we've been doing in our culture. And man, are we suffering or what? I mean, you know, you look at the suicide rates of young people. You know, first, their anxiety, depression, stress is a whole standard deviation worse than it was 30 years ago. But it isn't just self-report. Ooh, the poor dears are saying I'm stressed. No, the kids are actually dying. So don't be telling me it's just they're learning to talk the talk. We're not giving people the skills they need to do what you did in that moment and all these areas where that would work, which turns out is almost everywhere. If you did the same thing with asking that person out or going for that promotion or doing this new thing that you don't know how to do, but that you've always wanted to do, that you can maybe learn how to do, whether it's playing the guitar or singing or, you know, starting a podcast and making it be successful. That kind of hands in the air, I'm going for it. That's not suppressive. Be careful, because I know some people will hear, and I know you're not saying this because I know you have your interest in mindfulness and so forth. You're not saying this, that some folks are hearing. You just have to push the fear out and overcome the fear and just go for it. It's more subtle than that. It's like getting with the fear and carrying it with you. as you step into hands in the air, I'm going for it. And that's, you know, that will create success in every area of life it's applied. You know, I was down in Rio and I saw a person that was, I said their names, you'd recognize the person. My wife's Brazilian that went to Rio in the Olympics for the first time and saw somebody win a gold medal who has an ACT coach. I know the guy, I know what he was doing with that person, and I know some of the issues even they were struggling with. So, you know, CEOs of Fortune 100 companies, you know, this isn't about the mentally ill. This is about people. And can we empower people? Can we empower ourselves to live a full life worth living? The answer is yes. Science can be of help. And what you find is when you go there, there's a whole lot of old wisdom. You find monks there. You find hippies there. You find all kinds of strange allies when you go there. But that's cool. If a whole bunch of people are together in a clearing in a forest, but there's a whole bunch of different pathways to get there, to me that means that this clearing is important. We don't have to say, ooh, golly, you know, there's monks here. Yeah, because human beings have been working on this issue for a long time.
If you are not on the Elite Man newsletter yet, make sure you get on it right now. Go to elitemanmagazine.com/newsletter and sign yourself up today. Get all of our bonus podcast information, sneak peeks into upcoming shows, behind-the-scenes content, special offers, and exclusive Elite Man updates found absolutely nowhere else. You are basically getting a sneak peek into all Elite Man content, activity, and updates and news. You will be the first person notified when anything Elite Man related happens. I'm telling you, it's basically like getting a sneak peek into Elite Man headquarters. Go to elitemanmagazine.com/newsletter, sign yourself up, and become a true member of the Elite Man community. I look forward to speaking to you soon. elitemanmagazine.com/newsletter. You're so right, too. And I love how you have been able to apply this to, again, like so many different areas of life. And like when you mentioned that a moment ago, I didn't even actually make that connection of when I was able to do the roller coaster thing. I basically did the same type of thing, you know, in various parts of my life thereafter. And it was essentially the same type of skill, the same type of mindset and strategy that I used to overcome some of these different fears and challenges that I had along the way. And, you know, again, with dating, especially with women, that was a big part of my life. And I took an acting class, a dance class. Like you mentioned a great thing, like doing speeches, but also like even this podcast. When I first started the podcast, it was like, you know, getting some big names on the show. You always get that anxiety surrounding that. And whether you can get past that is really the definer of whether you're going to have a successful show or not. Like, you know, you can still have somebody on the show, but if it sucks and you don't sound good, you don't ask good questions, you're not really into it, you know, people aren't going to really listen. But if you can keep it up and actually practice it and get better over time because you're able to get past it, you know, that's when you start to see success.
It sounds like I'm disagreeing, and I am a little bit. If you can get with it, you know, you will get past it because it's just not relevant after a while. But sometimes then it shows up. I bet you sometimes even with all of your experience, you know, it's a really big person or you've had a conflict with them in the past or you hear something and now here comes anxiety again. Mm. You know, can you, when it comes and sort of inviting you to focus on it and struggle, meanwhile you can't focus on your guest, can you kind of respectfully decline the mind's invitation to fight a war within? I've got some work to do. Thank you very much. I've got this covered. And that's a kind of getting with, because part of the anxiety is just telling you sometimes how important it is. This is, I really care about this. I want it to go out really, really well. Yeah. You know, there's people, you know, who've won like Academy Awards, you know, like, who throw up before they go on stage almost every single time.
Yep.
Who cares? They're not going to win or lose the Academy Award for throw up. They're going to win it for doing the job. And sometimes for some people, that process of feeling that emotion and showing up. Others, the more, you know, like I used to be so afraid, and of course, inside the panic stuff. But as I learned to do what I talk about in the book, you know, the way I say it is, I gave up on trying to control panic. And what I said is I just had anxiety attacks. And then people would ask, well, are they less intense? I say, no, sometimes they're exactly the same. Here's the difference. If I had a panic attack afterwards, I did not want to do that thing again. I was much less likely to say yes. If I have number 10 anxiety, the max up there, and I handle it the way that I write about in Liberated Mind, the next time I'm more willing to say yes. Yeah, let's do it. I'll do it again. I'll do it again. So if anxiety is not keeping you in the cage, you know, it'll assume a level that fits the situation. And over time, that's for me, that's meant less than less anxiety. But, you know, I think it was a dozen years from kind of constructing ACT and walking in that direction before I had my last panic attack. And I've learned to never say never. If I have a panic attack right now, I'm not going to make that my problem. It might be a little bit of a problem between us because I might have a little bit of a hard time talking. And please, I pray, I hope, I got to decide in each moment, can I let it sort of show up, move through me, and then learn what's in there? Like one of the things that might be in there is it might be telling me something about this moment. You know, I'll give an example that sort of sounds a little bit like I'm shifting. People who've been abused often will learn to dampen down their sense of anxiety or even negative emotions at all. It's called alexithymia, where you suppress the emotions and you kind of stop knowing what you're feeling. It's a little bit of what happened to me. If you look at my first TEDx talk, you'll see where two or three years into the ACT journey, I discover how important the domestic violence in my house when I was a little kid was to me and my own psychology. But you know, people who have had kind of, I did see some really ugly, ugly things between my parents. But if you click into this alexithymia space, and by the way, men do it more than women, where you just don't even know what you're feeling, you're more likely the next time to get into a situation that will once again perpetuate the same thing that you are feeling horrible about. Like people who've been sexually abused or physically abused or emotionally abused, if they dampen down their emotions, are more likely to have those things that happen again. Exactly the people, the last person. So it's kind of like this. If you had feelers on the tips of your fingers, and you do, and you reached out and you felt like some really spiky kind of sandpaper with painful, thorns from a rose bush in it, and you said, okay, I got a solution. I'm going to just obliterate the feelers in my fingers. So I won't be able to feel that. Yeah, but then you can't feel your lover's face. You can't feel the silk sheets you're in. And if there is something sticky that you go like, don't put your hands there. Look at that spiky stuff. I might get hurt. You won't feel that either. And so you're more likely to have, so you want your feelers out, but you don't want to be overwhelmed by emotions. And what I do in Liberated Mind, that's one of the six processes, is teach people how to feel in a safe way where your feelers are out, but you're not going to be overwhelmed by your emotions. And, you know, men especially, you know, they push away vulnerability, they push away emotions, and then they just try to live life stupid. And it's not wise, but it's what we're encouraged to do, frankly, sometimes just inside male roles. I know your audience is both men and women, but I'm just thinking, you know, somehow I'm in that space. But so, how do we get with our emotions? And then, we'll get past, here's the part where I'm with you, get past those emotions being offense that keep you from doing what you really want to do. Yeah, I'm going to get past that.
I actually think that you can use the anxiety a lot of the times to your advantage once you're able to get with it and understand it. Just recognize, like, for instance, you mentioned a couple of good points too about, like, say, going on a date with a beautiful woman, or you're going on stage to make a speech, or you're going for a job interview that you really covet. These are like different situations where you need that excitement, you need that energy, and that's what anxiety really is. It's not like it's anxiety that's going to cripple you so that you can't make it to those events, but it's actually going to excite you so that you can perform at your best.
Exactly. Exactly. Right on. Perfect. That's exactly what I believe. But it's also what we can train. I mean, it isn't just like believe it like, oh, I believe. No, the science of it is really clear. If you learn how to do what you just said, Justin, man, you've got power inside your behavior now that wasn't there before. Because instead of asking permission of your emotions first, which A, you don't control, you don't know where even freaking they came from sometimes. You don't know why you're anxious. You know, it could be due to things that had to do with your deep, dark history and you had nothing to do with it. might have happened to do things when you're a kid, when you had no ability to control your environment. You know, what are you going to just keep perpetuating that over and over again? You're just a victim of your childhood, really? Well, if you don't want to be, you're going to have to learn how to handle the echoes from the past in a way that's healthy and that allows you to learn. Because as you say, some of that anxiety is actually just misinterpreted excitement. Or even if it's not misinterpreted, will, when you open up to the anxiety, give you a residual of excitement that'll help you get up, prepare, step forward, have energy. You know, it's not your enemy to feel. It is not. And there isn't any emotion, any, that you can name that you don't pay good money for. I mean, you buy books that make you cry. You go to movies that, you know, make you embarrassed. I mean, you do all those things. So stop running, show up, stand up, open your eyes, and let's learn the skills as to how to be here whole and free and focus on what we really want to produce in our life's moments. And the flexibility processes, as they say, are the 20% that does the 80%. And once you get that, add other things. Sure, great. But let's start with what science tells us with several thousand studies is empowering to people.
Yeah, I want to dive into the six processes that you talk about in the book in a moment too. But regarding that latter point you made about men not really like the alexithymia part of it and men kind of being more predisposed to that, I really think it is a key issue and something that guys really have to get over. And I think like on the show, we do a good job of helping guys express themselves more, understand themselves more, be more in tune with both the masculine and feminine parts themselves. We actually just talked about this a couple episodes ago with a Chinese medicine practitioner who's very in-depth about this kind of stuff and that balance of yin and yang. I guess yang is the actual pronunciation too of that word, which is, you know, some people say yang, including myself. But it's a good way to, it's a good thing to, I think, for guys to really think about and consciously be aware of the fact that, you know, a lot of the times you don't even realize that you're suppressing different types of things, different types of emotions because of past events. And also, again, like our culture and our society sort of dictates a way that they think men should act and men should be. And I just think it's so much more beneficial and healthy in the long run when men are better able to express themselves and actually feel, like you said, the feelings and emotions that they have to feel. And I love the analogy, too, of, you know, scrubbing off the ends of your fingers. Or another thing that comes to mind, too, is like babies who have that weird genetic condition where they can't feel any pain and they like sit their hand in the fire, like weird stuff like that. Like that, there's a reason why you have pain sensors in your body. And that's, you know, obviously one of the big reasons.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, men come by this honestly. There's an old study where they took babies and dressed them in pink or blue and then brought parents in and watched what they did with the babies. The blue babies were, it's the same baby. We're just dressing them in two different colors and randomly. Each baby gets dressed each way with it, but with a different participant in the study. When it was a blue baby, the babies were allowed to crawl away more than the pink babies. But when the blue babies cried, they didn't get picked up. When the pink babies cried, they did. So, you know, we should be a little kind to ourselves. The culture has sort of been saying, you know, that we're not supposed to, in a way, as men, to feel. And we took those command instructions and we called it masculinity. That's not masculinity. It's that space in which it's really hard to be a whole person as a man. And it's also the space by which, you know, things like domestic violence are more likely, or drug and alcohol problems, or, I mean, you go down the list. I mean, that same move is just not good for us. And so if we didn't get programmed properly, we're going to have to do it ourselves. And, you know, we're going to have to look at the science, but also look at our friends, change some of this culture, break some of the rules. And, you know, you want to have, I think it's really cool to have, you know, different ways of being in the world as a man and a woman. But this idea that men are not supposed to feel is, man, it's just toxic everywhere you look. And it means you lost your a really important guide. I mean, for one thing, like you look at the values piece and you write about values on your website. And we hurt where we care. It's a little hashtag for this book, by the way. If you want to go Twitter it, just put down the hashtag, we hurt where we care. Because, you know, we care And then that's the place we can hurt. But the places where we care, that's, but it goes in two directions. You know, like if you really want to have relationships, for example, that are intimate and committed and uplifting, well, what if you get lied to? What if you get betrayed? What if you are found to be, you know, you're not good enough? What if you get dumped? What if you, that's going to hurt. Well, that hurt comes because you wanted something. So when we do this dumbed down thing, it means now the only guide we have for achievement, for success, for performance, for progress is applause, money, and someone else's opinion. But it doesn't feel right. It's hollow, and we know it. Like if, you know, if we get the applause by manipulating people to give us applause, for example, who cares about the opinions of fools? You know, if you trick somebody into saying, oh, you're so smart, you know, it just hollows it out. So then now you've got success and it doesn't land well. And, you know, there's billionaires that blow their brains out. I mean, there's millionaires who are drinking themselves into oblivion. And why? I mean, they got the trophy house, the trophy spouse, the trophy job. They got it all. No, they don't have it all because they didn't even know what they were trying to get. And so pain isn't the only way in, frankly. I mean, joy is another way in, or your heroes are another way in, or just the kind of story you want. But if you can't get to what is of importance between, because you say so, between you and the person in the mirror, what your values are, you're flying blind now. I mean, you're going nowhere. And, you know, if you don't know where you're going, that's where you're going to get. You're going to get nowhere. Yeah. So, or you're going to get even worse. You're going to get the achievement that is not real, not really what you wanted anyway. If you can connect with what those values are and put them in your life, then no matter how it turns out, you've already got success. That's what I meant by that. First you win, then you play. Because I'm walking a values-based journey. This is what I want to put in my life. I'm doing it. Does that mean I got a lot of money? Does that mean the women will come to me? Or that? I don't know. But I do know that if I get people to come to or me, or if I do that success thing without it, it's not going to matter anyway.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, too, it's why like so many people, after they achieve something great, like they're still unfulfilled because they didn't even really know why they wanted that in the first place. It was kind of a... There was something missing there, and they just kind of thought they wanted it, but it didn't have any real substance to meaning in, you know, their heart or whatever.
Exactly. Exactly.
There's like a term too. You might know it's a psychological term, but like a depression that comes on later on for that.
Sure. But, yeah. Okay. No. But whose responsibility is it to put meaning into your life? It's yours, dude. Yeah, it's yours. So you better learn how to do it. And to do it, you've got, you know, this is right inside now the six processes. Because if you still let the judgmental dictator within run your life, it'll tell you what you care about because it'll just wag fingers at you and say, you're never going to be fill in the blank until you fill in the blank. In other words, I'm going to earn my way into something. Well, but the deep message of that is you're not there yet. There's something wrong with you. You have to change before you can actually even be yourself. Well, good luck with that, because if you start with that losing message, you'll end up with that losing outcome. And so you got to rein in the dictator within and use it when it's useful, let it go when it's not. You got to be more emotionally open because we hurt where we care. You got to be able to focus on what's important. So your attention better be under control. The part of you that knows how to make choices better be in here, this more observing, more spiritual side of you. And then you got to be able to pick meaning by choice, and then if you don't put it in actual behavior and build habits around it, who cares anyway? If you just know what you care about, but you can't actually organize your life around it, well, then that's a tragedy. And at rapid speed, I just gave you the six flexibility processes. Those are what's about in a liberated mind. I walk through every one of those with, you know, chapter-length things and a gazillion kind of cool studies sort of showing it and examples and so forth, and then in the latter part of the book, I walk through area after area after area after area of your life, of human life, and show how it's relevant. Not in a repetitive way, because you have to sort of see how it's relevant with each way. You know, that losing weight feels different than having relationships, but it's the same processes.
All right. So for anyone who missed that, including myself, can you can you just kind of break? I know the first one, or one of them anyways, is feeling in the safe way that we talked about before. What are the other five ones that I missed?
Okay, so the one I just started there of sort of learning to look at your thoughts, not look at the world structured by your thoughts.
Okay.
If you're a meditator, and you are, you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
You know that you get in the space where you're given a task, you put your mind on unemployment other than this one simple task, like follow the breath or focus on the point of the wall, depending on what the meditator tradition is, right? And of course, then your mind doesn't like being put on unemployment. And it starts giving you all kinds of things to think about, whether it's the itch on your nose or some scary thought or, oh, man, I'm doing a good job meditating today. It could be almost anything. Well, if you can't sort of just look at your thoughts the way you might look at a cloud or look at a leaf going by on a stream, well, then you disappear into that thought. Now you're looking at the world from that thought. Now you're hooked. You're had. You're captured, and you're running on automatic pilot. You just got to pray for good programming because you've turned your life over to your programming. And, you know, a lot of those words, you don't even know where they came from. It could have been mom's voice, dad's voice, the television's voice, you know, an old lover's voice. I mean, who knows? Could we instead just back up just a little bit? Not like mentally putting your fingers in your ears, but just wake up to the fact that there's a whole human being thinking, and notice your thinking. Metaphorically, it would be like if you wrote a thought in your hand, instead of putting it in front of your eyes, put your hand out at arm's length. Okay. You can still see your thoughts. You're not going to go crazy. It's okay. But it doesn't have to be freaking keeping you from seeing anything else. Can you look at it the way you'd look at it at arm's length, where you can still see other things? We call it diffusion. It's a made-up word meaning to kind of unpour, like defuse. The word fuse means to pour in Latin. Unpour lemonade so that you can sort of see lemons and sugar and water. It's like that. I can see that I'm talking and I'm thinking. I can see the world around me and I can make a choice. Is this thought helpful to me now? And especially if it's telling you stuff that, boy, that's an old thought. Every time I do what that voice says, it's a train wreck. I think I'll respectfully decline my invitation to follow that guidance. Or to struggle with it, because when you focus on it and struggle with it, it's now the focus of your attention. So we call it diffusion. The attentional skills is the next one, coming into the now without being jerked to the past in the form of rumination or the future in the form of worry, but instead, what's going on right now in your body and the world around you? What are the possibilities? And then be able to take that attention from this more perspective-taking sense of self or transcendent sense of self. There's not good words for it, but the person behind your eyes, the kind of the person that shows up when you're meditating, not the object of reflection and criticism, but the awareness, just pure awareness. Mm-hmm. And then direct your attention towards what brings meaning and purpose to you by choice. If we're up to you, what are the qualities of your behavior that you'd want to reflect in what you do over the next several minutes, over the next day, over the next month, over your life? What would you want? Well, what would it take to do that? It's kind of like, what would you want on your epitaph? What are you up to? By choice, not by guilt, not by shame, not by wagging fingers, not because you have to. And then that final one is competence. How do we organize our actual behavior around meaning that we pick by choice? So there's the six, the names for them: acceptance and emotions, diffusion of thoughts, flexible attention to the now, from this transcendent or observer sense of self that allow you to choose values and commit to a values-based path. And those six, when you mess them up, hurt you, and when you get them right, help you, and it's not that hard to learn them, and you spend the rest of your life practicing them. Because every time you hit something new, your mind tells you, yeah, well, that was great. All that stuff worked in this stuff in the past, but it's not going to work here. So it's, you got to keep doing it and doing it and doing it and doing it. It's like meditation. You know, what's the point? It's doing it and doing it and doing it. When you stop, you don't stop. You just keep doing it and doing it.
So what is the best strategies, or what are the ways that you implement this system into your life? Do you do things like mindfulness meditation or single point meditation, or do you practice things like the power of now, like Eckhart Tolle stuff, or is it just a combination of those different types of things, and then a philosophy of, you know, your mindset on a day-to-day basis?
Well, in the book, I walk through, probably if you totaled it all up, maybe 100 techniques.
Wow.
Every single one of them I do. And I kind of try to have my life be like a walking meditation. And yeah, I've used contemplative practice a lot. I used to live on an Eastern commune. I mean, I, as I say, you look talking about an old hippie guy. And I don't want, you know, you can use even contemplative practice selfishly. I mean, you take care of the kids. I got to go meditate. Oh, man. Don't do that, dude. I mean, I saw a food stand with a mindfulness burger. I mean, we know how to turn anything into junk. You know? But so contemplative practice, yes, and about 40% of the ACT trials have it in there. But what really resonates for me, and in the book I walk through a lot of personal examples, but also is using these acceptance, diffusion, flexible attention to the now, awareness, sense of self, values and committed action techniques, and just building out psychological flexibility into my life. Because we know, for example, the positive outcomes for meditation have to do with increased psychological flexibility, even at the neurobiological level. And so, and at the psychological level. So we're kind of in the same space. And in the evidence-based therapies, they usually say mindfulness and acceptance to connect them. They will use that almost as a phrase. And the big evidence-based meditation folks, you know, the Jon Kabat-Zinns and the Zindel Siegels and Marshall Linehans and all that, the evidence-based therapy ones are all my friends, and we're kind of fellow travelers. And so, yes to contemplation, but what I actually do is I live out what I write about in A Liberated Mind. I'm doing it right now. Nice. I'm doing some. Actually, can I tell you a story of this morning? Yeah. I did. Caught something. Okay, let's see if I can get it quick. I'm wanting people to write reviews on Amazon for A Liberated Mind, right?
Yeah.
It's been out, I guess, what, about now, what, 8-9 days, right? And it had a rush up when all the ACT fans bought it. It went up to 800 on Amazon. And then it fell back down to the 2000s and the 3000s, saying, oh, God, I got to get those reviews up. So when they go to Amazon, so I put out this little thing saying, if you write a review, and send it to me, I'll do a drawing. And every week for the next 8 weeks, I'll send out 6 signed copies. And I send this out to like 300 people out of the 1,000 who had asked for the freebies. And it didn't yet go, thankfully, to my 25,000 people who follow me on my, you know, on emails and stuff like that. But something felt wrong. And then it occurs to me, what are you doing, you freaking idiot? The reason why people want to write reviews is they want to guide people out there about what's of use. And I didn't say write a positive review, thank God. I would never do that. But I don't want people writing reviews because they're going to have a freaking signed copy. That doesn't make any sense at all. That externalizes what is a values-based thing. So now I'm trying to clean that up. I don't know if I'm going to take all 300 and buy them a book. That's about $10,000 by the time I send it out. But I'm going to do something to clean up that mess, because it was me slipping, you know, that this is a values thing. We're doing this to help people and to be useful to people. We're not doing it to get on the freaking New York Times bestseller list. I don't give a F about that. I mean, it'll be cool, fine. But frankly, who knows if that might be just a miserable thing anyway. I mean, next thing you know, all kinds of people are asking for attention or something. I don't know. You would know more. I mean, you've got maybe more of folks chasing after you to be on your podcast or whatever. What I do want to do is be in a cultural conversation with people about what the science shows. And so I'm going to clean it up, and I'm going to send an email to those 800. I'm drafting it with a guy who works with me, and we'll say something like, I'm sorry. You know, that was a little stumble, a little values stumble. And I don't want you writing a freaking review to get a signed copy from me. But I would like you to write a review that would help you tell other people what's of use or not in this book. You know, where to go, should you use it, who should read it, if you know, and if you just do that, I'll find a way to acknowledge you big time. And that's different. Acknowledging people for what they've done is different than trying to like get them to externalize and do things because I'm going to give them a prize or something. Geez, it's just so far away from me. So I slip and I catch in 100 ways. I mean, I walk through my days slipping and catching, and that's cool. You know, as long as you don't do a face plant into the asphalt, you know, if you watch somebody riding a bicycle, you see they're never 100% stable. They're always correcting as they go. So if you can catch it quick enough, that's cool. And to me, that's kind of, you know, that's like making life into a walking meditation.
Yeah, I like that, man. And I mean, you bring up such a great point, too. And I think it's human nature to do what you did earlier and or what you did, you know, prior to earlier was trying to get more reviews. And I've done similar things like that with, you know, past books and products I've had. And, you know, there's a fine balance, too, with it. Like you said, like, there's probably a better way to do it as opposed to sending people a signed copy if they give you a review. And obviously, you're incentivizing them to be more positive. But at the same time, it's like, you know, if you can reward them, maybe, like, create a special, you know, people who review create like a page where they get like a bonus gift related to the book or something like that. You know, if you really believe in the work you have and you know it's helping, which you know, you believe in it. I believe in it. You know, all the podcast listeners at this point believe in it. And the many thousands of people who've probably heard you along the way, or millions at this point, they believe in it too because it works. It's like, you know, where do you draw the line of spreading that message to more people to help more people? And where do you kind of say, like you did earlier, well, it's like, you know, this is a little too much. I want to kind of dial it back a bit, but I do want to incentivize it in some way to get to reach more people because the message is so powerful and it can help so many people. I mean, it's a fine balance there, man. I hear you 100%.
Yeah, it is. Well, what I wanted to do is get back to the acknowledgement, you know, and like the folks I went out to on this wasn't the folks I usually put on my newsletters and all that. It was people who asked for freebies because they bought the book. And, you know, and I gave them some really cool ones, you know, like an e-book, a cartoon book, Act in Nutshell with 12 images drawn by my 28-year-old daughter who went to Rhode Island School of Design, not too far from where you're sitting right now. Yeah. And they're awesome. I mean, I'm so proud of this book. I just love sending it out. I mean, it has images in it that just like stick in your head because they're like, awesome. Like the dictator within is like, whoa, this is a really cool thing. Essie, you wrote, this is beautiful. This is exactly what it's like in my head. And, you know, artists know how to do things like that. And it's really such fun to send that out. And I want to acknowledge people and I want to acknowledge the people who are doing the reviews. But you know what I mean? We're walking this fine line. And I'm really grateful that you resonate to it. We're walking this fine line of what are we really up to? And can we organize our life around that? So just even the word incentive starts moving off a little bit. And then if we go even a little farther, here's an even bigger incentive. And then here's the – no, that's not – especially not when you're doing a message that says, look, meaning is facing that person in the mirror and saying, this is of importance to me. And, you know, I know the reason why this book was doing well early on, we'll see what happens when people actually are reading it, because early on they're just going by reputation, you know, and or because I know they were doing it because they've seen these things work in their life. They've seen it help with people they love, and they want to buy the book to give it to people to read to benefit from it, but especially to give it to people who they might be able to lift up. I know that. That's what they're doing. And that's cool. You know, if it's real – it's cool. If it's artificial, it's not cool. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, there are people out there who like are trying to buy their way on the freaking New York Times list by, you know, just buying their own books and stuff. Yeah. Can you imagine what a horror that would be if it actually succeeded? That you would live the rest of your life inside that?
Yeah.
I mean, you will not value it. You will not. It will not lift you up. It will push you down because you'll feel the betrayal inside you. And even if you fool everybody, you're not going to fool yourself.
You're right.
And so gut check time. Let's stay with what we know. And it's back to that image. Stand up, put your head up, open your eyes, put your hands out. I think I really can help in the book show people how to do that in their behavior. But you already know that that's what you need to do. And that's not buying good reviews. That's what that was. That's not what I was ever doing. But, you know, I mean, yeah. I was slipping. I was slipping off a little knife's edge. So I caught it soon enough. Instead of sending it out to all 800, I sent it out to 300. And I sent a note to the guy who works with me, and I said, something's wrong. I don't feel right. And it took me a while. It took me like 3 days to figure out what's wrong. I just felt it.
It's good, though. It's good that you have that, too, though. You can reflect back on it. And, you know, some people will just do it, and then it's like, you know, it's out of sight, out of mind. They already did it, and then it's like, you know, I did it. Now we got to move on and keep doing other stuff. But it's like when you know intuitively that something's wrong, you'll at least go back and try to fix it and make it right, which, you know, I think at the end of the day, that's all we can really do.
Well, you're a mindfulness guy. You're a meditator, right?
Yeah.
Why would we do that? Well, because when you slip, when your attention slips, when you're hooked, when you catch it. You know, like, so if you're practicing, your attention goes away, you come back. Your attention goes away, you come back. Your attention goes away, you come back. Pretty soon, your attention goes away, you catch. My attention went away. So now you have flexible, fluid, and voluntary attentional control built right in part because you're catching when something's hooked you, when you've gone mindless. And if you can catch that sooner, well, then, you know, you can correct before you, you know, using that bicycle metaphor, before you do a face plant into the asphalt. And so I think it's like that in any learned skill. You know, when we get good at it, it doesn't mean that we're always, you know, I'm Ekman. I'm, you know, the Dalai freaking Lama says sometimes he gets pissed off. He's been meditating forever. So, and frankly, you know, we're pretty busy. I'm not sure we could do what monks can do. And we're trying to put that in the West. That's great. It helps. But maybe other things. Maybe we can pull that at its joints, not out of disrespect for those traditions and dharmas and all that, but out of what Western science is really good at. And it's getting down to the simplification that comes from understanding the process. You know, E equals MC squared is amazing because it's so simple. It's like one little thing, but it applies to everything. It's not simple meaning like it's easy, but I mean it isn't like a drawer full of bread recipes, you know, where every single one has to be done different. And when you understand the process, you can take, okay, that drawer full of bread recipes is actually only about 7 different things. Or metaphorically, I'm mixing metaphors, but that's what we've tried to do. And frankly, if there's anything I'm proud of, is that my tradition, my people, the journey we've been on, and it's in a liberated mind, has really done the work. And I'll say it this way, this sounds pretty prideful, but really more than any other approach in psychotherapy that's evidence-based, in my opinion. We have done the work to get it drilled down to what are the smallest set of processes that produce these effects. And then once we got there, then it turned out, hey, you know, that applies to business and sports, and it applies to, you know, stepping up to the challenges of a cancer diagnosis, or can you follow your diabetes regimen, or you just name it. And I do walk through that in the book. You don't have to believe me. Read it. And if you're sciencey type, go look at it. I mean, there's 50 meta-analyses of these processes, you know, analyses of all the studies. There's 50 of them. Wow. Just on our work. So it's a ginormous body of work, but it's a simple now message. It's kind of the E equals MC squared of the human mind. Oh man, that sounds arrogant. That don't cross that out. That's not true. But it's simpler. It's simpler. I can remember 6 things. And so 6 things you can remember, you can learn, you can use, and you can see. And in the book, I give people the tools, you know, try yourself, see if it applies to you. You can find out in a matter of days, minutes, certainly weeks. It's not a big investment.
Steve, I want to wrap up in just a moment, but I do want to ask you quickly on, because I know this is somewhere in the book, the people with specific mental conditions, like say bipolar or schizophrenia.
Yeah.
And all your research, have you found that they can benefit too from this, despite the fact that they have, you know, a different type of operating mind, like not from what most normal people have? What can they benefit from?
Yeah. Yeah, this is crazy stuff. This is really cool stuff. Will it take something like the chronically mentally ill, people who are schizophrenic, who have hallucinations and delusions? And the reason that we did this study was one of the first big ACT studies in 2004. graduate student, Patty Bach, did it. But the reason I did it is the late Albert Ellis. You ever heard of him?
No, I haven't.
Albert Ellis is one of the fathers of cognitive behavior therapy, dead now. And he couldn't say a sentence without cussing, so I'll just bleep out the cuss words. He said, "Hey, this is just for bleep, 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 eggheads." And I said, "Oh, man, dude. I mean, cognitive therapy sounds to me the way he was doing it. And Beck and some of the other ones sounds to me a lot more eggheady. This sounds pretty simple. You know, stand up, open your eyes, put your arms out metaphorically. We'll teach you how." So we said, "Okay, what could we do?" And my student said, "Well, let's do this study in the mental hospital. And we'll take chronic, mentally ill people with hallucinations and delusions. Let's see what we can do." 4 sessions. It's now been replicated twice. One by a team in Drexel in Philadelphia, one by a team in Ireland. 4 sessions, teaching them what? You know the movie A Beautiful Mind?
Yeah, good movie.
Okay, that's essentially an ACT movie. Not that, you know, John Nash, the Nobel Prize-winning mathematician, knew ACT, no, nor did the movie makers. But what he stumbled into was this combination of things that we've been talking about that allowed him to be both psychotic and a Nobel Prize winning mathematician. That's possible. You can actually do that. You know, like he says in the movie, of course, this is Hollywood, to the little girl, "I'm sorry, I'm not going to be able to play with you." Meaning, I can't get into the nitty-gritty entanglement with my hallucinations and still function. And at the end, when he's winning the Nobel and he looks back at the back of the auditorium, they're sitting back there. The hallucinations are sitting there, you know, like witnessing. Do you know?
Yeah.
So that's what we teach. We teach just normal folks to back up, watch their mind, to sort of accept the presence of the voices, for example, to be able to listen to them, but not be dominated by them. And then to focus on your values. What does your experience say? You know, and some voice hearers will tell you, sometimes the voice say things that are useful to you. Okay, well, let's be guided by those times. But sometimes they say other things, like you have to go kill people, or, you know, you have to go, you know, slash your wrists, or the crazy stuff, right?
Yeah.
Or you're on the Supreme Court, or whatever the thing might be. So we do that. What happens over the next year? 4 sessions, 45 minutes long, 50% reduction in rehospitalization. Been replicated 3 times. Now, are they still schizophrenic? Yes. Do they still have hallucinations? Yes. Do they still have delusions? Yes. But they also have a life. And we've shown that the depression that comes after psychotic breaks, etc., it's not a panacea. It's not like it's going to take away your, as you say, you know, that brain of yours when you're really hallucinating and delusional and so forth is probably going to give you that. But that's true in lots of conditions, chronic pain, etc. There's lots of conditions that just ain't going away. But can you still have a life? Yes. And I don't know. I mean, it's not yet. I'm not ready to sing hallelujah. We've had some failures of trials with the chronically mentally ill. It turns out that shorter and simpler is actually easier. You don't want to do long psychotherapy sessions and get this effect. But the bottom line is, yes, even that. People with IQs of 70, people have traumatic brain injury. I mean, you walk through the number of populations that this applies to, and you come to, as long as you can talk, if you can speak and listen, this is relevant. If you got a mind that tells you what to do, this is relevant.
That's awesome, man. That is so cool. And yeah, I just, I'm actually ordering the book right now, man. You don't have to incentivize me to leave a review either. I'm going to check it out and leave one in a couple weeks.
Please.
An honest one too.
Good, so. Bad, or indifferent.
But yeah, where's the link? Where's the website that the guys listening can check it out and get a copy? Actually, what's a final takeaway message you'd like to leave the audience, and then a place that our listeners can check out the book and actually the links and all that stuff for there?
Well, here's one of the takeaway messages. What you really want out of life, you can move towards, but not until you rein in the dictator within and how you learn how to be more open, more aware, and more actively engaged in building a values-based life. And that takes some skills. It's not a huge list. You can remember 6 things. You can learn them. And when you do that, life starts opening up in area after area after area. It's been shown. So don't give up. You know, if you're feeling like you're living life inside a cage, you know, maybe it's a cage made out of rice paper and those bars are actually like printed on it. It's really not that thick. It's an illusion. And don't trust me. Trust your own experience. But do give it a shot and be guided by the data. And it is worth, you know, 3,000 studies and 310 randomized trials and 40 years of work is worth something. So I'm not here, you know, just talking about personal experience. And I'm not here, you know, just kind of claiming this is true, trust me. I'm saying don't give up and focus on what's of importance. You can learn how to do that. And you can take these things that have been going in the wrong direction, turn them in the right direction with surprisingly little number of things to focus on and surprisingly short time if you're willing to open your heart, your head, and learn how to do it with your hands. Head, heart, and hands. Let's learn the skills. Let's see how it works. And the book will walk you through it.
Awesome. What's the link for that, the book?
Well, if you go to my website, it's Stephen C. Hayes, Stephen with a V, middle initial C, like Charlie Hayes, H-A-Y-E-S, all one word, no periods, StephenCHayes.com. And I don't, if you go here to, there and do what I'm asking you to do, you don't go on my list, you don't get emails from me, blah, blah, blah. If you want that, you can do that. I tell you barely clearly. You can, of course, go in and give me an email, and I'll put you on a list to email you my blogs and all that stuff. But StephenCHayes.com. If you want to get the stuff for the book, put a forward slash and then the title of the book with hyphens in between the words and all lowercase. A hyphen, liberated hyphen, mind, all lowercase. And if you do that, I'll send you some really cool things, including, if you buy the book, including my daughter's awesome act in a nutshell cartoon book, ebook, but a whole bunch of other stuff like an act toolkit and kind of skills and things you can use very quickly. And to me, that's not like what we were talking about earlier. To me, that's just an acknowledgement and a support for the journey that you'll go on if you get a liberated mind. It'll put you on a journey, and I want to support you in that journey.
Awesome. Thanks, man. Steve, thanks so much for coming on. Really do appreciate your time. And yeah, I'm excited to dive through the book in the next couple of weeks myself. And, you know, I know our guys are going to love this one. It was so awesome. So much great information. And take care, and I'll talk to you soon.
Super. It's really fun to be with you. Thank you, Justin.
If you want to get more content, more information, and extra bonuses I don't post anywhere else, make sure you follow me on Instagram right now. It's at Justin Stenstrom. That's JustinStenstrom. I'm posting pretty much every day throughout the week, most days out of the week for sure, but almost every day. And it's all kinds of information regarding health, wealth, business, life, dating, relationships, confidence, and so much more. I'm telling you, you're going to love seeing some of the stories I post about and the feed posts I post all the time. It's pretty interesting. It's pretty fun. I'm loving Instagram right now, so make sure you follow me, Instagram.com/JustinStenstrom, or just jump on your phone right now, pull up the Instagram app, and it's at Justin Stenstrom. All right, guys, I hope you enjoyed that episode. But before you go, there's one last thing I'd like you to do, and that's this. Subscribe to our podcast right now if you haven't already. By subscribing to the podcast, you get every single episode the minute they're released. Get all of our Elite Man podcast episodes and all of our world-class advice absolutely free. Subscribe now if you haven't already and become an Elite Man today. And yes, if you do love the podcast, leave us an amazing review. We really do appreciate it.